December the 3rd, Yechezkel, and we are starting Perek Chaf Gimel, chapter 23. I meant to bring with me today, and I forgot to bring it, a kinos from Tisha B'Av, which is very relevant to tonight's Perek, as we will see. So, the pasuk says, "Vayhi divar Hashem elai lemar." The word of Hashem was to me saying, "Ben Adam, son of man, shtaim noshim binos emachas hayu." Two women were the daughters of one mother. This parak is going to follow the deterioration of both the northern and southern kingdoms. The northern kingdom being the kingdom of Yisrael, of Ephraim, and the southern one being that of Yehuda. And they are called two women, the daughters of one mother, meaning that we were sisters, those two kingdoms, and how both deteriorated. Vatiz nena v'mitzrayim binurehen zanu. And they acted immorally in Mitzrayim, in Egypt, when they were young. So, meaning that even before we left Mitzrayim, we were already acting in an immoral way. Now, what the Perek is actually going to be discussing, Avodah Zarah, idolatry. However, as we've seen already in Yechezkel, and the truth is you see it in the Torah itself, that an analogy for Avodah Zarah is adultery. Because with Avodah Zarah, what happens is that we, Chas V'Shalom, leave Hashem and go to another God. So that is likened to adultery. And that is the analogy that's used very, very often. And here, this parak will use very explicit terms for adultery. And the intention is to be understood about Avodah Zarah. So, these two daughters, already in their youth in Egypt, they acted immorally. Shama moachu shedehen, v'sham isu dadeh v'sulehen. Now, what the Navi is saying is that there in Mitzrayim, these daughters acted immorally. They didn't actually commit the act of adultery, but they did things, or they allowed things to be done to them that were akin to adultery. And I'm not going to translate these words literally, which you can read the English. But the idea is that they didn't do the act of adultery, of immorality, as badly as they would later on. But already in Egypt, there were the beginnings of what was going to happen later. Now, we will, though, have to come back to these words, because the Navi could have picked other types of improper behavior, improper, immoral behavior, that still is not the actual act of znus. The Navi chose this one for a reason, and we'll have to discuss that as we move along. So, those are these two sisters. This is what they did already in Mitzrayim. Ushmo's son, and the names of these two sisters are Ahala Hagedola. The older one is Ahala. V'Ahaliva Achosa, and Ahaliva is her sister. Vatiena Li, and they were to me. Hashem says they were to me, meaning after Mitzrayim they were to me. Vateladna bani vonos, and they bore sons and daughters. Ushmo's son, and their names are Shomron Ahala. Shomron, which is the capital of the northern kingdom, is Ahala. V'Yushalayim Ahaliva, and Yushalayim, which is of course the capital of the southern kingdom, is Ahaliva. Now the reason why I wanted to bring a kinos with me that we use on Tisha B'Av is because there are two different kinos, particularly one that we say the night of Tisha B'Av, which have a dialogue between Ahaliva and Ahala. They have a dialogue between each other. The term is a little bit differently. Ahal Yivamo, over there it says, but this is the same idea, that they have this dialogue, and these two words are used in that kina on Tisha B'Av. Those who have never learned this parak in Yechezkel just see those two terms, and in the commentary it says it's a reference to one is the northern kingdom and one is the southern kingdom. But this is the source for using those terms for the northern and southern kingdoms. And the dialogue there is they're each lamenting what happened to them, how each one had a terrible time, and each one is trying to one-up the other one. No, I had a worse time. No, I had a worse time. I had more calamities befall me. No, I had more calamities befall me. I had more tragedies. No, I had more tragedies. And as we read it, we get a sense for all the tragedies that took place to both the northern and southern kingdoms, and that they can actually compete over which one was worse. So here is where the source of those two names are from. Now, what do these words mean, Ahala and Ahaliva? They both come from the root Ohel. What does Ohel mean?
Tent.
Ahala means her tent. Ahaliva is a contraction of Ohel Sheli Ba. My tent is in her. So, what is my tent? Hashem is speaking. So what is my tent when he says my tent? The Beis HaMikdash. So that's why Ahaliva, my tent is in her, refers to the southern kingdom, to the kingdom of Yehuda, which would be where the Beis HaMikdash is, while Ahala, her tent, refers to the northern kingdom, which, by and large, strayed from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, almost from the outset. When it was established as a place that was not willing to submit itself to Hashem. We know that when the northern kingdom split off, who's the one who started the northern kingdom? Yeravam ben Nevat. He started the northern kingdom. Was he doing an Avera when he started the northern kingdom?
No.
No. He was correct for starting the northern kingdom. In fact, he was told by the Navi, Achia Hashiloni, to start the northern kingdom. It was a punishment to Shlomo HaMelech, even though it did not happen in Shlomo's time. It happened in Shlomo's son's time, Rechavam, but it was a punishment to Shlomo HaMelech. And the northern kingdom was by order of Hashem. The split in the kingdom was meant to last only 36 years. But in the end, as we know, the two kingdoms never came back together until the northern kingdom was taken into Golus, was taken into exile. Who exiled the northern kingdom? The country is Ashur, Assyria, and Sancheriv is the king. That's right. He's the one who took the 10 tribes into exile. This is going to be brought up as we move along in this parak. We're going to see reference to him, so it's important to know the background. The reason why that happened is because after Yeravam ben Nevat, who was a great man, who was a very big tzaddik and Talmud Chacham, when he became king, but he could not stand for the kingdom for the people to give more credit or honor or pay more homage to the southern king than to himself. And the Medrash tells us, the Gemara says, that what happened is, now this doesn't mean that this dialogue actually took place, but it means that this is how we're to understand it. Is Hashem said to Yeravam ben Nevat, when Yeravam rebelled, what happened is Yeravam was afraid that if the Jews would be Ola Regel, if the Jews would go up to Yerushalayim three times a year from the northern kingdom, well, they're going to go to the southern kingdom to go to Yerushalayim, so what's the big deal? Well, what will happen is they'll walk into the Beis HaMikdash and he will have to go also, because all men, all able-bodied men must go to Yerushalayim three times a year. He'll have to go as well. The halacha is, the rule is, no one is allowed to sit in the sanctuary of the Beis HaMikdash. No one. Not even the Kohen Gadol. No one is allowed to sit down. Everybody must stand, except when they bow. But everybody must remain standing in the sanctuary of the Beis HaMikdash, with one exception. Which king?
Southern king.
Right, southern king. The Malchus based David. Only the Davidic dynasty is allowed to sit. So what would happen? You'll have the northern kingdom, the people will come to Yerushalayim along with their king, with Yeravam ben Nevat. They'll walk into the Beis HaMikdash, and Yeravam is thinking, we're going to walk in, and I'm going to have to remain standing, And Rechavam, my competitor in the south, he's going to sit down because he's a descendant of David HaMelech. And people are going to see he's the real king and I have a lesser sovereignty than he. And so he was afraid of this, and so he dissuaded, not just dissuaded, he persuaded and forcefully stopped the Jewish people from being Ola Rego, from going to the Beis HaMikdash 3 times a year. In order to do this, he had to do several things that were very close to being Avodah Zarah, not actual Avodah Zarah. And this is a classic example of Avera Goremes Avera. One Avera causes another Avera. He wanted to stop the Jews from being Ola Rego, from going to the Beis HaMikdash. That's a bad enough thing. So how did he do it? He set up guards to stop them. But then he felt that he also needed to provide for the Jews another way to worship, because the Beis HaMikdash was the central location. So therefore he set up two agolim, two calves, which of course are reminiscent of the Egel Hazav, the golden calf. He put one in the north in Shevet Dan, and one in the south of his kingdom. And that way the Jews would go there to worship rather than to the Beis HaMikdash. So that was in order to stop the people from going. He had to give them another way of worshiping. Not only that, but he abolished the yontif of Sukkot and instead set up a competing yontif, a new one, in Mar Cheshvan. In Mar Cheshvan, the month that doesn't have any holidays, he made a new holiday in that month to replace Sukkot, so that the Jews would not feel like going to the Beis HaMikdash. So here, that's what he did in order to stop them. That's what I say, that in order to, he's just trying to accomplish one thing, but therefore he has to do one Avera, another Avera, another Avera.
Where did he put the two calves?
One was in Dan, and the other one was in the south of his kingdom. Beersheba is in the southern kingdom already, so but I don't remember where the other one was. So now, so he did that. Yerava ben Nevat, therefore, is a chote, he's a sinner, Umachti es harabim, and he caused the public to sin, which is the worst possible thing. It's bad enough for a person to sin, even the most terrible sins that a person does, but if they're his own sins, it's bad, but it's not the worst. The worst is when a person gets others to sin. That's the worst of the worst. And so, we already know this. We know this from Ammon and Moab, who got the Jewish people to sin. That was their goal. They got the Jewish people to sin. That's why a Moab man and an Ammon man are not allowed to join the Jewish people, because they didn't just try to hurt us or kill us. They tried to get us to sin, which is worse than actual physical damage. Of course, we know with Hanukkah coming up, that's what Hanukkah was all about, that they were trying to get us to sin, trying to get us to give up the Torah. The result was, Hashem said to Yeravam, now as I said, it doesn't mean that he actually had this dialogue, but this is the way we're to understand it. The Gemara tells us that Hashem said to Yeravam, Chazor bach, do teshuvah, v'ani ve'ata uben Yishai yitailu began Eden. And you and I and the son of Yishai, which is David HaMelech, we will all walk together in Gan Eden. Imagine that. Hashem says, you and me and David HaMelech will all walk together in Gan Eden if you do Teshuvah. So Yeravam said to Hashem, Mi Barosh. Oh, who's going to walk first? Who's going first? And he said, Ben Yishai Barosh. David will be walking first. Yeravam ben Nevat said, it's not for me. Now,
the first time he said it, he put Yeravam first.
Right.
I heard this.
Yeah. Good.
He wanted to hear it again. Me and you and Benisha, you wanted to hear that a second time. Oh, you want to hear it a second time? No.
Very good. Okay, that is one of the explanations. What Chani is bringing up is that the way it's worded is that me and you and Ben Yishai will go in Gan Eden, which means Hashem put Yeravam ben Nevat first. Then Yeravam said, who will go first? But why do you have to ask? His name was already put first. So one of the explanations said is that he wanted to hear it again. There are other explanations given, but that is right. There was an issue over there. Now, it's true that ultimately Kavod is the thing that brought him down, the fact that he wanted the honor and couldn't get it. But you have to bear in mind, Yeravam ben Nevat was not a slouch. when he was chosen by Hashem to run the northern kingdom, he was chosen because he was qualified. He was the most qualified. He was not only qualified because he had leadership abilities, he was qualified because he himself was a great Talmud Chacham. And he himself was, the people recognized him as a great Talmud Chacham. He was the greatest of the great. And yet, the power corrupted him. That is what ended up happening to Yerubbaal.
Well, they tie him to his father. Does that mean that there was something about his father that was that trait?
It's a good question. I don't know. I don't know the answer. In the end, the Gemara tells us that he loses his chelak in Olam Haba. The worst possible punishment is he loses his portion of the world to come. So the kingdom, the northern kingdom, was almost founded on Avodah Zarah. Even though I wouldn't say that it started that way, but almost at its inception, there was Avodah Zarah that was popularized by the king himself. And almost all of the northern kings were involved in idolatry. Involved in this in one way or another. Of course, there were some that were worse than others. We know Ahab was terrible, but that's what went on over there. And so, that's why it's called Ahalah, her tent. Because the northern kingdom maintained its own tent. Rather than going to the Beis HaMikdash, they worshipped in the north. And therefore, they went into Galus before the southern kingdom by over 100 years. So those are their names. As I said, the capital of the northern kingdom was Shomron, and therefore Shomron is forever associated with the northern kingdom. Shomron is the northern kingdom, and Yerushalayim, of course, is the southern kingdom. The Pasuk continues with Pasuk Hay. Excuse me. And Ahala was unfaithful under me, Hashem says. She went. She left me, meaning the northern kingdom. Vatagev al me'ahaveha, and she desired those who loved her. El Ashur Krovim, to Ashur, to Assyria, that was close to her, meaning that she sought out Assyria Ashur, which means that the northern kingdom at a certain point desired an alliance with Ashur. They actually invited Ashur to come in to help them, strengthen them with their army. Now, this is ironic because in the end, that's right. Ashur is the one who takes them into exile. But initially, there was friendly relationships between them. The northern kingdom sought out Ashur. Lov she secheles pachos uskanim. The Navi is going to compare Ashur to a young man who's very attractive and would therefore cause this woman to commit adultery. Wearing techeles, which is really nice garments, tachos ustanim, which are various levels of hierarchy in officers, bachurei chemed kulam, attractive young men, all of them, parashim, rochvei susim, again officers, those who ride horses, batitain taznuseha aleihem, and she gave her adultery to them. Mivchar b'nei Ashur kulam, the chosen ones of b'nei Ashur, all of them, uvachol asher agva b'chol gilulehem nitma'a, and all that she desired and all their abominations, she became impure. Ves taznusea mimitzrayim lo azava, and her adulterous ways from Egypt she did not forsake. The Navi is tying what ended up happening to the conduct in Mitzrayim. Ki osa shachfu v'nureha, because her, they lived with when she was young, vehima isu dadei v'suleha, and they committed these immoral acts, the same thing as we saw before, vayishpechu saz nusam aleha, and they poured their adulterous ways on her. Lachein nisatiha b'yad me'ahaveha, therefore Hashem says, now this is midah keneged midah, measure for measure, therefore I have given her over in the hands of those who loved her. Meaning, those who loved her, Ashur, turned on her and actually took her into exile. B'yad b'nei Ashur, Ashur agva aleim, in the hands of the children of Ashur, that she had desired them. Hema gilu ervasa, they have revealed her nakedness. Now this is in a negative. This is not in an adulterous sense. This is as in pillaging. But now as in pillaging.
Oh, okay.
Her sons and her daughters they took. And her with the sword they killed. And she became a name for women. Now what that means is the Torah uses this phrase many times. Means that she became the example. When one woman wants to scare another woman about something, and they say, oh, you know what happened to so-and-so when she did that? You don't want to do that, because you know what happened to so-and-so, right? That's the idea over here. So she became like the example. Like they say, I'm going to make an example out of you. That's what she became. Ushfutim asuba. And they passed judgments on her. So that's what happened to Aliva. This goes back, of course, over 100 years prior to this Nevoah. That's what happened to the Northern Kingdom, which was ancient history already. Everybody knew this. And they all witnessed it. Now Hashem says, getting to Aliva, which is the Southern Kingdom, which is the one that still is intact, Vatera achosa Aliva, and her sister Aliva saw, Vatashkes agvasa mimena, and her desires were even more destructive than her northern sister. Vastaznuseha miznune achosa, and her adulterous ways were more adulterous than her sister. El bnei Ashur agva, to the children of Asher she desired. Again, it talks about their how attractive they were. Pachos usganim krovim. Levushe michlol, again different levels of positions, and wearing these nice garments. Parashim rochvei susim, they rode horses. Bachur echemet kulam, desirous young men, all of them. Va'era kinit ma'an, I saw that she became impure. Derech achad lishtehen, the same way for both of them. Both women did the same thing. Vatosef el taznusel, and she added to her adulterous ways. Vatera anshe Mechuka al hakir, and she saw. Now this literally means men that were engraved on the wall. Tzalmei chasdim, forms of the chasdim, which is the nation of Babel. Chakukim ba shashar, that were engraved ba shashar, which means that's a type of engraving. It's a form of engraving. So, what does that mean? It means that she had a desire now, not only for Ashur, but now for the Kastim, for the people from Bavel. Why did it say they were engraved on the wall? Because she didn't even see them. It's not like they were there, and so she had an interest in them. All she saw was an engraving of the Kastim, and yet she had a desire for them, yet she sought them out.
Were those idolatrous drawings?
That's not what the intent is over here. It means that she saw a picture, and then she wanted. Right now, that's the mashal. That's the parable. What actually is being described is that she wanted to form an alliance and join up with the Kastim, with the Babylonians, even though they weren't even there. They were distant away, and she heard about them and knew about them, and she wanted to join up with them. Chagure Azor b'masnehem, they were belted in their midsections. That the Babylonians were known for that. Sruche tevulim b'rashehem, this means that they were wearing different types of fancy hats. Mar'e shalishim kulam, they all appeared like generals. Demus b'nei Bavel kastim, the formed like the people of Bavel, the kastim. Eretz Molad, tell them the place where they were born. Want to bring a chair over here? Okay. Vatagva alehem lamar e eineha, and she desired them for what she saw. Vatishlach malachim alehem kastim, and she sent messengers to them in kastim. So she sent for them. Vayavo eleha b'nei Bavel u'mishkav dodim, and the b'nei Bavel, the people of Bavel, came to her. They traveled to her, Lemishkav Dodim, to commit adultery with her, Bayitamuosa, Pesaz Nusam, and they defiled her with their adulterous ways, Batitmavam, she became impure in them, Batakanafshamehem, and then Batekanafshamehem, then she rebelled against them. She pulled away from them, she rebelled against them. That means that at one point there was an alliance. I'll describe what happened historically in a moment. And then the Jews, too late, tried to sever ties with Bavel. Batagal taznuseha, Vatigala Sarvasa, and her her adulterous ways became revealed. Her erva became revealed. Vateka nafshi me'alel. So I cut off myself from her, says Hashem. Kasher nak'a nafshi me'al achosa, like my soul was separated from her sister. Vatarbe'es tazusel, she increased her adulterous ways. Mizkaris, it made me urela, to remind the days of her youth. Again, hearkening back to what happened in Egypt. Asher zansa be'aretz Mitzrayim, that she was acted that way in Egypt. Vatagva al pilag shehem, and she desired to be their pilagesh, to be their concubine. That she desired, even if she couldn't be a wife to them, at least she could be a concubine. Asher b'sar chamorim b'saram v'zirmas susim zirmasam. That after trying to pull away from the Babylonians, then she turned back to the Egyptians, which goes back to when they were still in Egypt. But now, towards the end of the reign of the first Beis Hamikdash, they started to seek an alliance with Egypt and to become a pelagish to the Egyptians. And here, this is a very famous pasuk: "Besar chamorim besaram v'zirma susim zirmasam," which literally means the flesh of donkeys is their flesh, and the seed of horses is their seed, referring to the Egyptians.
Is that all it is? Just referring to the Egyptians? They keep mentioning these horses, like the horse with the horse rider on it. It's like a double entendre here of some sort.
Egyptians are always compared to horses.
No.
Because the horses come from Egypt.
Not sheep. Oh.
They're also compared to that as well. That's Rav Avodah Zarah. The horses come from Egypt. But here, this pasuk, that their flesh is the flesh of donkeys and their seed is the seed of horses, it's used on a couple of levels. One level is that the Egyptians are called shtufei zima, that they are entrenched in adultery, in immorality, the Egyptians are. And apparently, not being a farmer, I can't say, but apparently horses, donkeys, that they act this way. There's apparently everything is done in the open. Moreover, that just as, this is the Gemara says, just as with animals, there is no yachas, there is no lineage that follows the male. The only lineage is through the female, because you don't know which is the male, since the females will be involved with a lot of males, and therefore there's no way to know. So when a baby horse or donkey is born, you only know who the mother is, you don't know which father it is. So too with the Egyptians, you never know who the father is. It's all only through the mother. The Gemara tells us that when the pasuk says with makas bechoros, when the firstborn were killed in Egypt, it says ki ein bayis asher ein shames. There was no household that did not have a death. Somebody died in every household. So Rashi explains, what do you mean somebody died in every household? Was there a firstborn in every household? There wasn't always a firstborn. Why did every household have to have a death? So the Gemara says, and Rashi brings it, that the Egyptian women would frequently commit adultery with many of the bachelors that were living around the city. And so there could be many firstborns in one household. Because then it says, they said to Paru, Kulanu Mesim, we're all dying. What do you mean we're all dying? The firstborns were dying. They said, no, Moshe said only the firstborns are going to die, but in my house, six people died. Why? Because this person's wife had lived with so many other men, and each one was a firstborn to the other man. And so many people died in the same household. So that's what it means, Besar Chamor and Besar and Zirmasusim, Zirmasam, that they do not have a lineage. They only have a lineage through the mother, not through the father. So I'm going to read one more pasuk, and I'll tell you the history of what happened with the different alliances. Vatifkidi es zimas neurayach, you remembered the immorality of your youth. Vaasos mi Mitzrayim dadayach leman shedei neurayach. Again, the same thing, when the Egyptians acted immorally with you in these ways. The history is as follows. When the northern kingdom was taken into Galus by Ashur, by the Assyrians. At that time, the king was Chizkiyahu, who was a tremendous tzaddik. And we've talked about this before, that then Sanherib turned his attention to Yerushalayim and tried to conquer Yerushalayim as well, and miraculously, because of the great righteousness of Chizkiyahu and his davening, Sanherib's army was decimated, and the Jews were saved. And at that point, Assyria went down. It lost its power. They were the world power. He had almost conquered the whole world, and then almost overnight, it was overnight, they lost their power completely because the army was completely decimated, totally wiped out. The next nation to begin to gain power on the scene was the Babylonians. And when Chizkiyahu came, when Babel started to come to power, there were some emissaries of Babel that came to Yerushalayim, and Chizkiyahu showed them around. He showed them everything. He was being friendly with them and showing them around, and he is taking the task for it. Now you have to remember, we're talking about Chizkiyahu HaMelech. We're not talking about a slouch. We're talking about someone who's a great tzaddik. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, on his level, he apparently was too chummy with them. And in that way, the Navi is saying that the southern kingdom reached out to Babel. And that is called becoming immoral with them. What's the problem? Because remember, the issue over here is not really immorality and adultery. The issue really is idolatry. And we do have to keep our distance, even though, of course, we have to maintain cordial relationships with our neighbors. But one has to be careful not to become too chummy. Because when we become too chummy, then we begin to become influenced by our neighbors. And that's not good. And on Chizkiyahu's level, he was taken to task for becoming a little too close to Babel. And as a result, the Jews started to learn from the Babylonians' ways and to deteriorate. Then the same Midah Keneged Midah happens, that Hashem is going to bring the Babylonians against the Jewish people. Towards the end of the first Beis HaMikdash, the Jews try to rebel against Babel, as we've seen. Yoachim tries to rebel, Zedekiah tries to rebel, and they seek out help from whom? From Mitzrayim, from the Egyptians. That's, if you remember, when later on, after the Beis HaMikdash will be destroyed, and Gedaliah ben Achikam will be left in charge of the remnant of the Jewish people, and then he's murdered, where do they all run to? They run to Egypt. That's like the last place to hide from the Babylonians, from Babel. But that doesn't help them either. And that's what he means over here, that they reached out to Babel, then they tried to pull away from Babel, and then reached out again to Egypt, who they had reached out to when they were young. And that doesn't help them either. And so Hashem says in Chaf Beis, Lachain Ahaliva, therefore Ahaliva, the southern kingdom, Kalma Hashem Elokim, Hineni Me'ires Me'ahavai Chalaich, I am going to raise up the one who loves you against you, meaning Babel, Esa Shenacha Nafshech Mehem, the one who you try to pull away from, Vahavei Sim Alayach Misaviv, will bring them against you from all around. Bnei Babel, the Chol Kastim, the children of Babel, and all the Kastim, Pekod Vishoa Vikoa, Kol Bnei Ashur Osam, these are different places that are all around Babel, and also the Bnei Ashur, Machurei Chemed, Pachos, Uskanim, Kulam, again, these are references to how nice they looked, and their positions, Shalishimu Kruim Rochvei Susim Kulam, all them ride horses. Uvo Alayech, they're going to come against you, Hotsen Rechev VeGalgal Uvikal Amim. Those are different types of weapons, and different types of formations of armies. Sina Umagain VeKova, a sword, and a shield, and a helmet. Yasimu Alayech Saviv, they'll put against you all around, which means they'll siege you. V'nasatim Lifneihem Mishpat, and I will place before them judgment. This is very important. Ushvatuch b'mishpateihem, and they will judge you in their judgments. I will place before them. I will place before them judgment means, as Rashi explains, I Hashem want to punish you, and I'm going to appoint them to be my emissaries, to be the ones to do the punishing. So I'm going to put judgment before them, which means I'm going to give them the ability to carry out my judgment. Yet, Ushvatuch b'mishpateihem, they will judge you with their judgment, which means once I set them against you, they can do whatever they please, which means they can do worse than I tell them to do. I'm not going to be speaking directly to them. They're not tzaddikim. They're just going to, I'm just going to let down the defenses and let them in. Once they're in, yes, they will carry out my judgment, but they will also do what they choose to do. This is a very important concept, which I think we've spoken about in the past, and it's important to be aware of it if we haven't, and to reiterate it if we have. There's an age-old philosophical question, which is, no, I think we have talked about this, which is that can one person use their free will to hurt another person more than the other person deserves? Can that happen? And the answer is yes, it can. Yes, the person can. How do we know this? Because at the end of David HaMelech's life, Hashem says to David, because of a sin that he did, that the Jews would have to be punished. And he offered David three choices. Who knows what the three choices were?
A plague.
A famine.
It was three days of a plague,
or a famine, or an army coming against them. So David HaMelech says, we say it in davening, David says to God, the Navi who had come to him, he says, Tzadli ma'od, I'm very pained about this. And then he says, I want to fall in the hands of Nipla Navi al Hashem. I want to fall into the hands of Hashem. Kirav Rachamav, because he has a lot of mercy. V'yad Adam ala Pola. I don't want to fall in the hands of man. I'd rather get punished directly from Hashem than through man. I don't want an army to come against me. I'd rather have the plague, because at least I know that's directly from Hashem. The question is, what difference does it make? Either way, he's going to be punished. So what difference does it make if it's going to be a plague or the army? Either way, the army will cause damage, the plague will cause damage. But the answer is, the plague will only do exactly what Hashem wants it to do. But once a foreign army is brought in, making their own free choices, free will choices, they can choose to do more damage than Hashem had chosen for them to do. Now, I explained this before, that does not mean that a person can be hurt when they totally do not deserve it, completely don't deserve it. Mrs. Kaiser, I'm going to use you as my example. If Mrs. Kaiser is a tzadekes gemura, which I'm sure she is, if she has absolutely no sins, completely, totally clean of every possible sin, and then I choose to slap her, and I try to, somehow I won't be able to. Somehow it won't work. Whether I will trip, and it won't be miraculous, I'll just trip and won't be able to do it, whether I'll just miss, whether some kind of force shield will pop up and stop my hand, but something will prevent me from doing it. Because you can't hurt a person where there's no way for the pain to get to that person. So the person has absolutely no sin. But, well, let me say the other extreme. The other extreme is a person has acted in a way that Hashem has decided to punish them. And then they can be hurt and will be hurt one way or another, either through a person doing it to them or through some natural act that will hurt them. But there's always a middle ground. And most of us fall into that middle ground. That middle ground is that we're not perfect. Unfortunately, we have sins. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in His infinite mercy, does not choose to punish us immediately. He gives us time to do teshuva. So he's marechaf. He waits for us to do teshuva. Or He punishes us in little, small things. So that instead of some terrible pain, instead of chas v'shalom, a person breaking their leg, so instead, they stub their toe here, they trip over there, they bang their shin over here, they have some frustration and end up having to come late to something, or they miss the bus and they have to walk home. All these things can add up to what would have been chas v'shalom, a broken leg. And Hashem, in His mercy, will spread it out. So just because a person may have sins doesn't mean that Hashem has chosen to give them a punishment right this minute. But if someone walks in with their own free will and says, I don't like that person, I'm going to punch that person, well, there is a room for that punch to get there. Because there is sin. And even though Hashem would not have necessarily punished them in this way at this time, but because of the person's free will, the other person's free will to try to hit them, that will then be the punishment, and that will be the atonement for the sin. So when it says over here that Hashem will punish, will give the judgment to the Bavel, to the Kastim, and then they will judge with their judgments, because of their evil ways, they're going to add to what Hashem wanted to happen. Now, as I said, it doesn't mean that the Jews were completely undeserving of what was added, but Hashem himself, had he brought, let's say, a plague, it would not have been the same type of punishing. Yeah.
How can someone tell if the test, like what Abraham or Yitzchak or Yaakov had, if they're feeling pain, or if it's a punishment? Like,
okay.
How are you supposed to know what to learn from
it? That's a very good question. That's a very hard question to answer. The Gemara says an answer which isn't going to help us.
Mm-hmm. I didn't get the question. What's the question?
How does one know if I walk along and I stub my toe? How do I know whether that's a punishment or whether that's just a test to see whether after I stub my toe, am I going to yell at my kid? Right? We couldn't imagine anybody doing that, right? Right. So what? Right? Is it? Which one is it? How do I know? So the Gemara says that there's such a thing as Yesurin Shal Ahava. Yesurin Shal Ahava means afflictions of love. That Hashem only gives it to a person in order to increase their Olam Haba. A person, Hashem knows this person can handle afflictions, can handle difficulties, and Hashem wants that person to be able to increase their schar in the world to come. So Hashem says, look, if the person has an easy life and serves me, they'll get this much reward. If he has a tough life and he serves me, he'll get this much reward. And I know that this person can handle it. So I'm going to give them a tough life so that they will then earn more in the world to come, which of course is much better than this world. So the Gemara says, how do you know whether it's Yisurin Shel Ahava, whether it's afflictions of love or not? So one answer is, if you are a perfect tzaddik, right, she's rolling her eyes, right? So how do we know, right? How would you know? I mean, none of us are perfect tzaddik, so how would we know? The Gemara also says that if the afflictions cause bittul Torah and bittul tefillah, if they cause a person to lose their Torah learning and lose their ability to daven, then it would not be Yisurin Shel Ahava. Then it would be because of some kind of a sin, possibly. But that doesn't help us either, because even if it's because of a sin, it doesn't mean it's a punishment. It can still be an opportunity to grow, to overcome, and then do tshuva for the sin. It doesn't have to be a punishment. See, what we really want to know is not if it's Yisurin Shel Ahava, if it's afflictions of love. We know that we're not on that level, because all of us would be much better off with an easier life than a harder life. We all know that. But what you're really asking is, how do I know if it's a punishment or whether it's just a way of making me a better person and improving me, and so that I can do tshuva, etc. So the answer is, there's no real way to know. There's no real way to know. However, the guidelines are as follows. When a person has some kind of affliction, what they should do is do some introspection and think, can I line this up with something that I know I need improvement in? If it's obvious to me that I need improvement in this area, so that if I have a pain in my mouth and I know that I'm not careful with Lashon Hara, do I know for sure that this is because of Lashon Hara? I can't say I know it for sure, but it's a pretty good guess, right? And therefore it makes sense to work on Lashon Hara because I got the pain in my mouth. It just makes sense. It fits. And that's what a person should do. But my Rosh Yeshiva of Weimar, Zechana Racha, used to say that any type of real big issues that come up are not punishments. We're not on the Madrega. We're not on the level for punishments. People who Nebuch had terrible tragedies in their lives, when I was in Baltimore, I know of these families, just terrible deaths in the family and tragedies in the family, other sorts of tragedies in the family, and when he would come to speak to the family, to the people, the first thing he would say is, this is not a punishment. It's not a punishment. Don't think it's a punishment. It can't be a punishment. We're not on that level. A punishment is to get a punishment like that means that we have to deserve something like that as a punishment, means that we would know well enough to do better. And we're all basically good people. Yes, we do things wrong, but we're not on the Madrega, we're not on the level to do the terrible sins that we find here. You have to be on a much higher level to do a really, really terrible sin. And so, or you got to be very depraved. But none of us are like that. So he always said right away, it's not a punishment. It is a way of improving. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has all kinds of reasons for it, and that's the way he presented it. Always. Now, if you stub your toe, there already you could say that that's a punishment. That's the type of punishment which we might deserve. Like stubbing a toe 10 times in order to make up for it. That's possible. But even when we stub our toe, what's the right thing to do? To think, did I walk to do an Avera? Did I use my feet to do an Avera? Did I try to, right? That is the correct reaction when a person has some sort of pain.
You really would show gratitude if you were on that level, that if you stubbed your toe and you were doing Lashon Hara, it would be really a sense of gratitude instead
That's
of
correct.
Punishment at all.
That's correct. That's correct. That we say on Yom Kippur, we say, there was an old Yid in Baltimore, his name was Rabbi Walk, Rabbi Yosef Walk. He was a mechanach, he taught in the boys' schools, he taught in the girls' schools, he was all around mechanach. He was nifter several years ago, and he once told me, I'll never forget this, he once told me that we say on Yom Kippur, we say every davening, we say Hashem, Yehi Ratzon, at the end of Shemoneh Esrei, we say Yehi Ratzon, Shelo Echad Ha'od, I shouldn't sin again, no more. Whatever I've sinned already, Hashem, you should cleanse it with your great mercy, but not through afflictions and terrible sicknesses. Don't give me that. You should cleanse me from my sins, but don't give me that. So he said to me, so then what do you want? What do you want? I'll tell you what you want. You want to stub your toe. You want to have frustrations. You want that the appointment didn't work out. You want that you came late. You want that you missed the bus and you missed the plane. That's what you want. Because that's not Yisurim and Halayim Raim. Those are, in the grand scheme of things, minor issues. Mm-hmm. And that's ultimately what we want to happen to us. Because that's how Hashem cleanses us without these terrible, terrible things happening to us. So he said a person should thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu every time these minor afflictions happen. And the problem is when we're in the moment, everything seems to be big. You know, I missed the plane, it's like, oh! Right? But in the grand scheme of things, take a step back, it's not so bad. Okay, so I missed the plane. Alright. You know, in the end, the grand scheme of things, it's not a terrible sickness, chas v'shalom. It's not a terrible affliction. And that's the way to look at it. And that's what it means. Hashem is merciful that he stretches it out. And right. So that's what he's
saying. Rabbi Prinsky, how do we answer what happened in India then? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there again, I would apply what my Rosh Hashiva said, that it was not a punishment. Now, we don't know the answers. We don't have a Navi. We don't have a prophet. So we can't know for sure. We can only make suggestions. That's the only thing we can do. And I'm going to tell you something that my Rosh Hashiva said. I may have told you this before. I'm going to tell you something my Rosh Hashiva said and regarding a couple, a young couple that went through a terrible tragedy. I'm going to tell you what the tragedy was and I'll tell you what he said. Now, bear in mind that even when he said it, he said he doesn't know for certain this is the reason. He was only giving a possibility because he wanted to expand their way of thinking because they were thinking we're terrible people. We've done terrible sins and that's why we were punished. And he was saying, no, that's not so. And here is one possibility and you can use your own thinking to try to come up with other types of ideas like this. There was a young couple. I was still a bachur in yeshiva. I wasn't married yet and I was married. Learning with at that time he was a younger man. He had been married for a short time. He was a mentor of mine, and I was learning with him. It was a big schus for me. It was a good thing for me to be able to learn with him. Every night we learned after Marv, and that couple had a son, an infant, a baby, and that baby passed away. Mm-hmm. It was a sudden death, and it was a terrible thing. An 11-week-old baby. And it was terrible. It was just terrible. It was our first child, and it was devastating. So I went to be Menachem Avol, and when I got there, my Rebbe Rav Tzvi Berkowitz was there, and the person who was sitting Shiva was telling Rabbi Berkowitz what the Rosh Hashiva had said when he had come. I was not there when the Rosh Hashiva came, but he was repeating what the Rosh Hashiva had said, and the Rosh Hashiva had said to them, "This is not a punishment." And you shouldn't ever think it is a punishment. And he said that, who knows? Who knows what the reason is? We can't say for certain. But I'll give you a possibility. And the possibility could be that maybe, he said, maybe you and your wife are for whatever reason, whatever, you know, it's in the stars, it's in whatever it is, whatever the reasons are, you and your wife were never going to have children. that it was impossible. The way things were set up, you would never have children. And then Hashem, in his mercy, decided that you could have children if you went through this difficult period. So he gave you a child, took it away from you, and in that manner you can grow to the point that now you can have children. Maybe that's the reason. That's what he said. This family today, Baruch Hashem, has many children. They have a large family, Baruch Hashem. I can't say the Rosh Yeshiva said the real reason. He himself didn't know if it was the real reason. But that's a suggestion. That's an idea that's out there. The Rosh Yeshiva told us once, I was once at a Torah Masorah convention, and we were talking about history and studying history, and he was saying how it's impossible to study history if you don't do it through a Torah perspective, because history is the study of cause and effect. And how do you know what is the cause and what is the effect? You can't know unless you have a Torah perspective. So he said, I'll give you an example. He said, the secular world says the Jews in Europe in the time of the Holocaust were like sheep to the slaughter. And it was a terrible thing. And you know what? You know who's to blame for that? It's all of the Gedolim. All of the great leaders, the Talmidei Chachamim of the Jewish people, they're to blame. Because they told everybody that America is the Treifa Medina. Don't leave Europe. Stay in Europe. And anybody who wanted to leave, they convinced them not to leave. Stay in Europe. Stay. That was the call of the Gedolim. Stay in Europe. And as a result of everybody staying in Europe, they were massacred. Had people left, then far fewer Jews would have been in the grasp of that terrible man. And so they were destroyed because of the Gedolim. So the Rosh Yeshiva said, of course, that can't possibly be the case. We know that it's our job to listen to the Gedolim, and Hashem wants us to listen to the Gedolim. And if they say not to leave, then we're not supposed to leave. So then how do we understand it? So he said, well, I'll tell you a possibility. He said, I don't care how you explain it, but you're going to have to say, because there's no way to look at it otherwise, that the state of Israel is a result of the Holocaust. I mean, one led directly to the other. The destruction of European Jewry, only a few years later, the state of Israel, the whole guilt of the world at large is what influenced the UN vote. I mean, the whole thing was clearly a direct result of the Holocaust. Had it not been for the Holocaust, you wouldn't have a state of Israel. So he said what would have happened if the Gedolim would have pushed people to leave Europe? Then people would have left. Where would they have gone? Well, they might have gone to the United States. There were immigration laws in the United States. It was a little bit tough. Where would the vast majority of people have gone? You know, Zionism was very strong in Europe in that time before the World War. It's very, very likely that a large portion of the Jews leaving Europe would end up in Israel. So he said, if you would have had a large concentration of Jews in Israel during World War II, perhaps Hitler, Yamach Shemo, would have set his sights on the Middle East. And he would have concentrated his efforts to get into Israel, because that's where the Jews were. Because we all know that's ultimately what he was after. He was after us. And who knows, maybe he would have forgotten Eastern Europe, or he wouldn't have gone so much for Eastern Europe. Maybe he wouldn't have attacked Russia. Instead, he would have attacked south and trying to go through and get to, at the time, was called Palestine. Maybe that's what he would have done, and he would have actually wiped out the old yeshuv, the old settlement in Eretz Israel. So perhaps, again, it's only conjecture. So perhaps because the Jewish people remained in Europe, and because they were wiped out, maybe that's why it was possible for there to be a state of Israel afterwards. He doesn't know for sure, but this was a suggestion. So when we look at these things, these terrible tragedies that happen, and we know that it can't be a punishment like the Rosh Yeshiva said. What they went through over there in India was too horrific for it to be called a punishment. It's got to be something much more fundamental than just a punishment. So then, what is it? So we can't say, we don't know for sure. Perhaps the people who were killed there, murdered, and who were more than murdered, who were put through such a terrible, terrible time, perhaps there was a far worse tragedy that Hashem had in store for the Jewish people, And these people there, whatever it was, six people, right? Mm-hmm. Perhaps those six people were such special people that Hashem said that I'm going to use them as a way of protecting everybody else. That through their going through this terrible, terrible tragedy, that they will atone for the rest of the Jewish people, and I will not have to bring the punishment. That's always a possibility. We don't know. We don't know.
Rabbi, actually, it's funny because I was trying also to second guess God, trying to find out what was in store, and I don't believe in punishment at all. I don't think punishment exists. I don't think anything that goes wrong in anyone's life is a punishment.
I have to stop you. We know that punishment exists. We know there's schar v'onesh, there's reward and punishment. We just don't know how Hashem does it.
Yeah, but I mean.
We don't operate looking for punishment. That's what you mean. We don't explain things by saying it's a punishment.
Exactly.
That is correct.
So I always think that it's a reward in that way. And to very humbly to have a guess what happened with Mumbai's people is that if you look at the consequence of their death, the movement of Chabad and the other movements, and the way that everyone united in Israel for their burial, and how everyone is adding mitzvot to our mitzvot in their honor, maybe the six people died in a car accident, because, I mean, that was their time, in a way. So they would have just had a car accident, we were going to be very sorry for them, but that was it.
Right.
And they had a chance to die in a Kiddush Hashem, right, and have like all the other Jews performing mitzvot
in their honor. So that's very possible, that it would serve to bring us together. That's very, very possible. That sort of is. Now they are called, remember that when people are killed in that way, they are called Kedoshim. They're called the holy ones, like the 6 million. Now why are they called Kedoshim? Because even though we don't call it a punishment, but it goes without saying that in their death, they had got kapara, they atoned for any sins they ever did. Not to say that they deserved a punishment for those types of sins in that way, but whatever amount of sin they had, and who doesn't have sin, it was definitely wiped away in the way that they died. And as a result, we can say with certainty that their place right now in Olam Haba is pure, is without sin. And that's why we call them Kedoshim. That's why the 6 million we refer to as Kedoshim. Because those who went through such an incredibly difficult, terrible time, there's no way that they could have anything left on their record. And so they must be holy. They must be pure. So saying that their sins were atoned for is not the same thing as saying that they deserve to be punished. It's two different things. So we don't look at it as a punishment, but we do acknowledge that their sins were wiped away.
Some of you have Yishuv Merkaza Rav, which that happened to, and we united, you know, during that or whatever. And then you have these six prisoners languishing with the Arabs. We don't know if they're all still alive. You have Jonathan Pollard languishing. I mean, it seems almost, because we're all feeling the pain of these Jews, it's hard not to feel like we aren't being punished.
Yeah.
I can't tell you why or what for, but we're all suffering.
Who's being punished? That's the question. That's the point. It may be a punishment for the Jewish people as a whole. That could be. But it's not a punishment against those people.
Not against those people, but all of us as a Jewish people are suffering.
Yes. Yeah. And that could be a communal punishment to all of us, a wake-up call to all of us that we need to do teshuva. That goes without question. There's no question the response is teshuva. That's without question has to be our response.
It brings unity, and it also makes us more aware. I tend to think God takes the souls of these people to the highest level of the world of the souls. And maybe he is gathering his people up for the Mashiach times, these certain souls, because there was a baby that was not born yet. And you know how we've read that better not to have been born and to stay in the womb. That baby is pure in that world of souls. So it has an effect on the entire world, thank God. And it will affect us positively, we hope, because it's a great catalyst. I feel like God taps us on the shoulder, and then when we don't listen, it goes stronger and stronger and stronger until it is so aware. And there was some wonderful emails on that touched on something you just said.
Right.
And she also said, it made everybody feel more united. I mean, our hearts cried. We couldn't, 3 days there, we were miserable just thinking, where are these people? Are they safe? Are they not? Praying constantly. And then you have to accept God's will. Because in my opinion, I don't think we'll ever know. It's God's world. And we're just supposed to learn from it and do what we can do on an individual level. Right.
But we do need to respond with Teshuva. That's question. Otherwise, the lesson is wasted.
I agree with everything Tim said. However, there's still tremendous solace behind. I mean, Mr. Teitelbaum now leaves an almana with 8 orphans.
It's horrible. There's no question about it. The pain that to those individuals is the same as to the ones who were killed, meaning that they're bearing the brunt of it, but it's not a punishment to them. If it is a punishment, it's a punishment to all of us communally. And it is our responsibility to join in their pain, to be nosei ba'ol, to carry their pain with them, and that we need to respond with teshuva. The worst thing to do, the Rambam says, that when a tragedy befalls, chas v'shalom, if a person doesn't do teshuva, then that, we've spoken about this in this class, if a person doesn't do teshuva, then they're cruel. They are achazari, they're cruel. So my Rosh Yeshiva is saying, what do you mean they're cruel? They're apathetic. What do you mean they're cruel? No, but they're cruel, because if the reason why Hashem brought it was in order for us to do teshuva, and chas v'shalom we don't do teshuva, then what option does that leave Hashem? Chas v'shalom, it has to happen again. So that's a cruelty. That's an achzarius. That's a cruelty.
But how do you know what we're doing teshuva for?
So that's where we don't have a Navi, and Hashem doesn't expect us to have a Navi, and we have to do our best. You know, that's the kind of thing which, you know, He doesn't expect us to know for sure. In the time of a Navi, we would go to the Navi and say, okay, what are we supposed to do? Right, but unfortunately, we can't do that these days.
Well, one thing that I did notice in all the emails and the news stories that are going around is that the couple has been portrayed in a very beautiful way and as doing service to hundreds of people and really very defending themselves in an enormous manner, and obviously referred to as religious Jews, ultra-Orthodox Jews, you know, whatever that's supposed to mean, you know, which is on my nerves, but so the language that's being referred to religious Jews are being referred to in a language that is beautiful, as opposed to religious Jews being defamed and demeaned in Israel. You know, you hear in the Jerusalem Post, it's Orthodox Jew is used in a derogatory manner.
Right.
And so this, internationally, this couple has, I guess, brought...
It's a Kiddush Hashem.
It's a different manner of looking at religious people.
What's happening is that the American media, even though they lost other Americans in the hotel, are focusing on them. They're focusing on the Jews.
Well, that's also...
But, you know, it's so interesting that the terrorists went after a small Chabad house, is probably the only rabbi, out of how many, 1 billion people that live in India, that they momish targeted.
Yeah.
Rabbi, even Jews, while